Talkers.
Welcome to Speak and Destroy, episode 15. Speak and Destroy is a podcast about all things Metallica. I'm your host, Ryan J. Downing. My guest this episode is Alex Skolnick, legendary guitarist of Testament. I have a strong memory of the first time I saw Testament on Headbangers Ball. I captured the video for Trial by Fire on VHS and would rewind it over and over, watching it alongside the small handful of thrash videos that would make it onto the MTV show, generally about three videos over the course of as many hours. Lead guitarist Alex Skolnick stood out to me right away, with his red guitar splashed against the band's otherwise black instruments and black attire. The New Order quickly became one of my most cherished cassette tapes. I picked up the first album as well, and soon, through various fanzines, I learned that Testament was originally called Legacy, and that their first singer, before the magnificent Chuck Billy, was none other than Steve Zetro Souza, the man who replaced Paul Bailiff in Exodus. What a small and magical world full of incredible thrash the Bay Area seemed to me, growing up on the south side of Indianapolis. I continue to follow Testament through various lineups and label shifts, and I can happily say that their three most recent albums, The Formation of Damnation, which marked Alex's return to the band after a time away, Dark Roots of Earth, and Brotherhood of the Snake are among the band's best. Easily one of the best rock guitarists of all time, and once a student of Joe Satriani, which we also talked about, Alex is rightly revered as much for his proficiency at heavy metal guitar as he is his diversity and breadth of expression. He has a degree from the New School for Jazz and Contemporary Music, and in addition to Testament, he's been a member of Sabotage, Trans-Siberian Orchestra, and Stratofurious. His stature as an important figure in the Bay Area thrash scene is more than enough to warrant an appearance on this podcast. But moreover, the ever-articulate and creative Skolnick is just as impressive for his cultural commentary, often found on his website and Facebook page. I highly recommend reading his essays, for lack of a better word, on Metallica's Lulu, their performance with Lady Gaga at the Grammys, and the time Kanye West was photographed in a Testament shirt, all of which we discuss in this episode. Alex is also a core member of Metal Allegiance, the all-star band who assembled to play covers on Motorhead's Motorboat, and have now written not one but two original albums packed with guests. Last month, I hosted a Q&A at the Musicians Institute in Hollywood with Metal Allegiance members and part-time participants David Ellefson of Megadeth, Mike Portnoy, Andreas Kisser of Sepultura, Mark from Death Angel, and Mark Menge. Alex was on tour with his renowned jazz outfit, the Alex Skolnick Trio. Though I didn't get to see him at MI, I was thrilled when he agreed to come on to Speak and Destroy, and it turned out to be what I believe is the longest episode so far, with a wide-ranging discussion covering his early adventures with a guitar, and so much more related to our shared love and respect of Metallica. Quickly, before we get into this episode, do you have a question that you'd like to hear answered on Speak and Destroy? Drop an email to speakanddestroy@superherohq.com, or hit me up on Twitter at Ryan Downing, or head over to one of the Speak and Destroy socials. Speak and Destroy is on Instagram, on Twitter, on Facebook. Ask your question in any one of those places, and maybe we'll start doing some questions and answers here at some point. And right now, the best way you can support this podcast, if you're enjoying it, is to go into the iTunes store or wherever you consume podcasts and leave a 5-star rating and a review. We recently cracked 100 reviews. Thank you for that. Please keep them coming. The more of those we get, the higher the visibility of the podcast and the more people can discover it and participate in these awesome conversations about Metallica. So here it is, my conversation with the great Alex Skolnick. This is Speak and Destroy. Missed you at the MI thing.
Yeah. Sorry, I couldn't take it. I was up in Northern California.
It was fun. We were, David was talking about it being the 35th anniversary of Megadeth, and I pointed out that it was the 30th anniversary of the Megadeth t-shirt that I was wearing.
Oh, awesome.
purchased at my first ever metal show in February 1988.
Wow. So
almost to
cool.
The month. Yeah.
Still have it.
Still have it. It can still almost squeeze into it. I pulled it off, I think. I have very few like pictures from childhood and memorabilia, but I do have my Megadeth and Slayer shirts from 1988.
Well, that's worth celebrating, especially that you can fit into it.
Yeah, exactly. That's what that's what Andreas was saying too.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was a lot of fun, and it was definitely a nice kind of life full circle moment because, you know, David had originally applied to Musicians Institute, and MI had found an apartment for him nearby, which was the fateful apartment where he was neighbors with Dave Mustaine. And then he ended up not going to the school.
So look what happened.
Yeah. And then some serendipity for me personally, and that Megadeth was my gateway to all of this. And, you know, to hear Mr. Ellefson on stage, identify me as his very good friend of many years was kind of a, you know, you kind of take a moment and go, this is awesome.
That is really cool.
So yeah, let's talk a little bit about how your journey began. Was there music around the house? Did you have, you know, were there records that you were hearing? What was young Alex Skolnick all about?
There wasn't much music around, to be honest. There were a lot more books. I have Ivy League intellectual parents who have, they're just like extreme academics, with PhDs from Yale in psychology and sociology. And, music, there was a turntable, but it wasn't used that often. I didn't hear much music until, but I always noticed music in cartoons. I always liked the classical music, the classical themes that were sort of incorporated into Bugs Bunny cartoons.
Like Flight of the Bumblebee, I think, was one.
Oh, yeah, or the Barber de Seville.
Yes.
Or, Franz Liszt, or The Marriage of Figaro. You can think of so many.
And it's great how those cartoons were giving us a classical education unbeknownst to us, you know?
Yeah, I didn't realize that till years later. And then I would hear these melodies, and I said, wait a second. I remember that from Bugs Bunny. And so I think I was always drawn to that. And I first noticed rock music, and I would hear like early rock and roll, like Rock Around the Clock. And I think, when I was a kid, it was the 70s. And that's when I first noticed music. They say pop culture happens in 20-year cycles. So 20 years after the 50s, you have the 70s, and 50s were sort of making a comeback. You had Happy Days on television.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was Grease in the 70s also?
Grease was in the late 70s.
Yeah, and that was, very set in the 50s.
Yes, American Graffiti, which was a little before my time. I think I was sort of barely conscious when that came out. But apparently that, just really brought back, the whole, love for the 50s. And at the end of the decade, we're talking like really 1980. The beginning of the next decade, I think like the last of these types of movies came out, and it was called American Hot Wax, and it was kind of a dud at the box office, and it had these sort of B-list actors named Jay Leno and Fran Drescher. But what really got me with this movie was it starred all these 50s artists as themselves. So you had Jerry Lee Lewis in there playing himself. Screamin' Jay Hawkins, who many consider him like the first heavy metal artist.
Sure.
In a way. know what I mean? He was doing Alice Cooper before there was Alice Cooper. And Bobby Darin and... I think the Shirelles, a few different girl groups, but the one that really knocked me out was Chuck Berry. And he just stole the show and just completely blew me away. And this was around the time I discovered Kiss. And And yeah, it was really sort of discovering these things on my own. And I think that same year, the Blues Brothers movie came out.
Yes.
Right? And that had a tremendous impact as well.
Yeah, that had a huge impact on me. Also, I think when we first got HBO, I mean, back, you know, before there was even premium cable, when it was just your local network affiliates and then you paid for HBO, the Blues Brothers seemed like it was on all the time. And that definitely shaped my young mind in terms of music, style, comedy. There are a lot of things I can still trace. Yeah.
Me too. Absolutely. I can still quote the movie almost verbatim, it seems like. And I started playing guitar that year. So we're talking, yeah, I guess I started playing guitar. I was 10, 1980, 11. Yeah, I turned 12 later in the year. So I'm playing a little bit. And, you know, the Blues Brothers music was, you know, some of it was, you know, pretty complex to transfer to a guitar. You know, we're talking big horn section. But then it has the Peter Gunn theme in it, which I'd never, you know, I was too young for the original Peter Gunn show, but their version of the Peter Gunn theme, okay, I could figure out that riff. And with American Hot Wax, I had a great guitar teacher at that point that showed me all these 50s tunes. And I also liked Kiss, and I loved the Beatles. And of course, the Beatles were influenced by Chuck Berry. And conversely, you know, Kiss, in his own way, was, you know, they had some of these early, sort of signature early rock riffs incorporated into their music, even though it was, you know, much heavier music.
Did you see very recently, you know, Gene Simmons has been promoting that Vault thing that he's put out with all of his unreleased solo material.
And I saw, is that what that is? I didn't know what that was.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
I lost track of all the Gene Simmons headlines.
It is a 38-pound safe.
Oh, my God.
And it has hundreds of songs. It has what I believe is the first ever Gene Simmons figure without makeup or a costume. Like, it's a Gene Simmons action figure, like in street clothes.
Mm. Oh, okay.
And a bunch of other odds and ends. And then part of the appeal, as it were, is, you know, you pay several thousand dollars and Gene will hand deliver the vault to your front porch. Show up and hang out at your house. But in promoting it, the reason why I bring this up is in promoting it, he talked about, you know, there's a song he did with Bob Dylan and all these different collaborations. And he said, I don't know how if this claim is to be believed or how much basis in fact there is, but there was apparently some sort of missed opportunity at a Lennon and McCartney Gene Simmons collaboration that was said to have been on the books and then just didn't happen for whatever reason.
Weird. Wow.
Imagine that.
You never know. You know, you never know.
So and, you know, and you know, Ozzy, I've gotten the opportunity to interview Ozzy many times over the years, and McCartney's like his hero.
Absolutely. You know? That's his favorite musician. And I know that, and I've had arguments with people that, you know, they say, oh yes, you know, Sabbath and Zeppelin are the greatest bands, Beatles are overrated. Well, you would not have those bands if it wasn't for the Beatles.
Right.
And if you ask the members of those bands, they would all agree with that. So
the Beatles would tell you Chuck Berry and Screamin' Jay Hawkins and everything you mentioned.
Absolutely.
Yeah, sure.
Absolutely. So it's, I think that, it's important to know your history. But I, you know, so I liked all this music, and it never occurred to me that there was any, I wasn't really aware of categorization. You know, like, I didn't see why you couldn't love Kiss and Chuck Berry and the Blues Brothers and the Beatles. Yeah, it was all totally related, and it all went into my, you know, my formative years of guitar playing, which were also influenced by the fact that I have an older brother who doesn't play anymore, but he played in some local bands, started on guitar, switched to bass. And so I used to go to these clubs and, you know, I would see how the local scene operated.
By the way, my older brother, also a local band bass player.
Uh-huh.
It's interesting coincidence.
Yeah. No, it's really like an eye-opening experience. And, you know, until my brother started playing these clubs, I didn't know that. You know, you don't, there aren't just big concerts. You can go see,
same here.
concerts in these little places, and sometimes the bands are really good, sometimes they're not so good, you know. But some of them are really good, some of them will go on to be much better known bands, and through the local music scene that my brother was in. Now, he, at the time, he was in new wave bands, which it was, you know, as it was called, the sort of cleaned up music influenced by punk, but it was much more commercial. And
that was my first love, all that era. Where you're a, not a whole bunch older than me, a few years older, and that was my formative stuff, was Adam and the Ants and Generation X, and
sure,
and
yeah.
That was the stuff my older brother was passing down to me, and that was when music sort of swept me away, and that was prior to discovering metal. I actually went right from that stuff into metal via Megadeth. So,
right, well, yeah, there were, it's interesting. There was a lot of kids in school would sort of gravitate to whatever was pop. There would be these trends, right? So, when I was in junior high school, it was, for some reason, it was popular to like Ozzy. Like, everybody was an Ozzy fan. And then a year or 2 years later, it was passé to like Ozzy. And everybody had moved on to new wave. And it was the British, the English Beat, Madness, Oingo Boingo. And I didn't mind that music, but I still liked Ozzy.
Mm-hmm.
I was getting more into Ozzy. And wow, Ozzy was in this band called Black Sabbath before that. Now I'm checking out their record. So suddenly I wasn't cool anymore. And, but it was, you know, it was the whole social dynamic thing was interesting. And I never really cared about that. I just, you know, I liked the music I liked. And I liked some of that new wave stuff. But I knew playing wise, it wasn't for me. And I thought, you know, guitar wise, hard rock and heavy metal was just much more exciting. And also at the time, even the bands my brother was in that were more, you know, ska and new wave bands, they would cross paths with the metal bands. It was really interesting. So anyway, the Bay Area music scene at this time, you know, I'm sort of observing it, going to my brother's shows. You know, I'm not old enough to get into these clubs, but I go along, you know, and I'll help carry a speaker cabinet, you know, to get in and, you know, make myself useful. And I just, I watched, you know, the local shows, and I watched the clubs, and, you know, and occasionally there were these small, these very small world situations. So, my older brother was in a band called Freaky Executives, and it was it was one of these ska new wave bands. And
such an 80s name too. That's great.
Completely. And their guitarist had been in a metal band for about a week. His name was Mike Mong, and he ended up replacing Kirk Hammett in Exodus for about a week.
Wow.
You know, at the time, I didn't know any of this. Like, I didn't know who Exodus was. I didn't know who Metallica was, but I just met this guy. He's the new guitarist for the Freak Executives, and he was talking about his band. And then the guys from Exodus started they would go to the shows, Freak Executives. So I met them as just like, you know, friends of the band. And eventually, you know, they replaced Mike. I think the next guitarist was, you know, their classic guitarist, Rick Hunolt. And then suddenly they were gigging, and then it was time to check out this band, Exodus. And then, you know, so at that point I'm like, okay, now I'm sort of in the know with metal. And then, you know, Exodus does shows with Slayer, who's playing for the first time in the Bay Area. And so it's just interesting. It kind of led to knowing all these people, catching these concerts at a really young age, and eventually, you know, hearing about this band that supported Exodus called Legacy.
Yes.
The guitar player left the band, and they need a guitarist, so I hear this through the grapevine and try out.
And their singer was playing guitar originally, right? The singer before Zetro?
Oh, no. I thought Zetro was the original singer.
I want to say that there was a guy named Derek. Does that sound right?
Oh yeah, Derek Ramirez. He never. I don't think he sang, or maybe in the bedroom he sang.
Right. Like early. Maybe there was an idea that he would sing.
That's possible. Yeah, that's totally possible. But when they did their first gigs, it was Derek and his cousin Eric on guitar, and Zetro on vocals. And then, as we all know, Zetro would eventually join Exodus, and I mean, it's kind of amazing how it all happened. But it all started with me, just sort of meeting the Exodus guys because they were friends with the band my brother was in, which wasn't even a metal band. It was this completely new wave ska band, but they loved that band too. If you ask any of the Exodus guys about Freak Executives, they'll all talk very fondly about them.
Now, where did Joe Satriani enter into the mix for you? Were you already?
Yeah. If we go back just a couple years to like 1980, where I'm like 11 years old. At that point, I'm studying with an acoustic folk children's artist, and I grew up in Berkeley, California, so it actually totally makes sense. And, but he was great. The guy's name was Gary LePoe, and he would play at sort of, it's so Berkeley, playing at like anti-nuclear weapons rallies, and he had amazing. These sort of Berkeley protest songs, but he was just a great teacher. And within about 2 years, I just felt the need to study with another teacher and move, cause he was really more of an acoustic singer songwriter. And at that point I could figure out songs and I could play songs. I think I still thought I might want to be a singer guitar player, and somewhere along the way, probably by the time I was 14, I believe I heard Randy Rhoads for the first time on Blizzard of Oz, and I think within the same month I heard the first Van Halen record, even though I was a little late to that. It had been out for a few years, but the effect that hearing Eddie Van Halen and the first wave of Van Halen and Randy Rhoads on those first couple Ozzy records.
Two guys just redefining and recreating an instrument, like from whole cloth. Yeah,
completely. That just changed everything. And I felt such a connection to what those guys were doing on guitar. It just seemed, even though it seemed like a very lofty goal to be able to play like that, there was just some connection to it. And I just thought, this is the type of guitar player I want to aspire to be. So this was a couple years into, my studying guitar with the folk singer songwriter guy, who was great, but he didn't do that type of stuff. So
you went to the folk singer and said, "Can you show me this finger tapping stuff?" And he's like, "Huh?"
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. There's this song called Eruption. But actually before that, I studied with a few different guys. A friend of mine up the street had started playing guitar at this point, and he was studying with, a local player who's more of a blues guy, played a Stratocaster, but he could do all the Mark Knopfler licks. Dire Straits was really popular at the time. That's great guitar playing. There was great guitar playing that wasn't metal too. I mean, the Police was out. I still love the Police. And I wanted to learn that stuff, but that was a little more advanced than, you know, the 50s rock stuff I was learning.
The Police was so complicated, and when you I went back and watched not that long ago, I showed my kids actually the a concert from the Synchronicity tour. Right. And what's so brilliant about The Police is how it's like great design, right? Where, or great editing in a film, where it seems really simple. And then when you pay attention, just a layer beneath the surface, you're like, this is so complicated.
Oh, yeah. There was so much going on.
Yeah.
The musicianship was really solid. You know, and I think I knew I wasn't ready for Van Halen and Randy Rhoads. I knew I couldn't jump into that. You can't just jump into that stuff. But, you know, the guy I was studying with, yeah, briefly, he showed me Mark Knopfler, Andy Summers, a little bit of David Gilmour, you know, and it was cool. It was lead guitar, but it was manageable. And then I moved on to some local players, and it's just, you know, it's an interesting small world. Okay, so there were two guys in the Bay Area, at least in like the East Bay, that were considered like the real hot shots, right? So one guy, his name was Bob Coons, and he was the older brother of Michael Coons, who was the singer for the band Los Rocket, which is Los, and Los Rocket is a whole other story, right? That's
yeah,
the first band Metallica supported in the Bay Area. I mean, there's a very famous flyer. Yeah, Los Rocket was special guests imported from L.A. Metallica. Right? So Mike had this older brother, Bob, and Bob could shred like nobody's business. But he was also, he was so into sort of prog rock and sort of quirky rock, you know, King Crimson, you know, jazz fusion. So he wasn't in any of the well-known rock bands, but he could play like a beast. I mean, he was just the fastest picker I ever heard at that time. And then the other guy who was kind of considered the big guy on the scene, his name was Danny Gill. And Danny played in a couple different bands. He played in a band called Diamond, which would often support Los Rocket. And they were a little bit more, they were a four-piece band. They were a little bit more like, and they had, there was a, it was a one guitar band. So it was a little bit more like a Van Halen. And they would do these shows with Los Rocket. Yeah, Los Rocket, I always thought was more like, a little bit more like a Judas Priest.
Mm. Yeah,
two guitars,
sure.
Lead singer, everything. Danny, Diamond didn't, they lasted a year. They had a great year, but then I don't know what happened. They split up. They got a new singer. They moved to L.A. Things didn't work out. But at one point, they changed their name to Guilt, and they had Chuck Billy on vocals.
Wow.
And it was how I, yeah, it's just crazy. The whole story is just insane. And that was how I first met Chuck Billy, and that was before I was, you know, playing in a band of my own yet. And Danny was the first guy. So Danny was actually a good friend of my brother's as well. And they had tried putting bands together. They were never able to play together in a band that was established for some reason. They both played in different bands that did really well in the clubs and made names for them, yet never together. But before they were out, you know, playing in their own bands, they would be rehearsing in my backyard. Like, I would hear these guys rehearse. And Danny was the guy, he was the first guy that sort of figured out how to do the Van Halen technique.
Nice.
Now you have, you have so many, you have all these instruction videos on how to do it. You have 10-year-old kids in Japan playing Van Halen licks, maybe even younger, you know. But at the time, like, nobody did that. It was so rare. And I remember seeing Danny, you know, doing the eruption thing. I'm like, that's insane. Like, how do you do that? And, you know, this is before you could, like, get videos of Van Halen himself doing it.
Sure.
And so I started studying with Danny. And Danny was my teacher, I guess, from the time I was 12 till the time I was 14. You know, great player, and I learned a lot from him, but I got to this point where I would bring something in that I wanted to learn, and I felt like he didn't really know how to do it. So then I would try to learn it myself, and then he'd be asking me, how are you doing that?
Right.
I remember there, I think there was
the student becomes the master. That old cliche, yeah, right?
There were a couple of these licks where I would come in, I think I figured out how he's doing this. Yeah, you know, wait, show me that. You know? So it was great, but I needed to move on to another teacher. And I knew that both Danny and Bob had the same teacher. And his name was Joe. And I didn't know anything else about him except that supposedly he's a disciplinarian. He takes no bullshit. So you have to practice your lessons. And he was known for firing students.
Students that's awesome.
Instead of fire the teacher, he would fire students, and he had a waiting list. So you needed him more than he needed you.
It makes me think about martial arts movies where the student, you know, sits outside the monastery in the snow for 3 days to prove they're worthy of being let in, type of thing. You know,
it was a little bit like that. His waiting list was like over a month, and he also. He was known for, I at this point, everybody knows who I'm talking about. He's a nice guy. He's not a mean guy, but he would tell it like it is. And he was known for cutting people down to size if they deserve to be. And both Bob and Danny, they were like kind of best on their block, but they, yeah, when they would study with Joe, he would just tell them the truth, which is, you know, they really, yes, they had some good things under their sleeves, but they, you know, to be on a, you know, in the big picture, they really both had a lot to work on. And anyway, both of them had stopped studying with him and decided, I don't know, they didn't need him, or maybe they, you know, He wasn't giving them enough credit, and didn't recognize how good they really were. I'm not sure what it was, but both of them basically told me I shouldn't study with them. So these are both my previous guitar teachers
telling me
not to study with the guy they had studied with, despite the fact that you know, I'm hearing that this guy is the best. This guy's like, he's come from the East Coast. He's very serious. He's on this whole other level. And I thought, God, that's so interesting. Why would I choose not to study with this person? So, yeah, long story short, the Joe turned out to be Joe Satriani. And he was a great teacher, except you had to leave your ego at the door. Hmm. And,
You weren't going to be showing him anything you had figured out.
No, that was not going to happen. Definitely not. And within a couple of years, he was off and running. You know, he was on his second solo album. His first was actually an EP, and his second one was his first full-length album. And his student from back in New York, Steve Vai, at that point was becoming very well known, He'd become the guitarist in David Lee Roth's band, and
Isn't that interesting too when you talk about the small world and the connections that we go back to Eddie Van Halen and that first wave of Van Halen, and then as you're talking about Steve Vai and Joe Satriani, Steve Vai ends up in what's now kind of the classic David Lee Roth solo lineup, and then Satriani ends up playing with Sammy Hagar and Michael Anthony.
yeah, that's true. That is
Just
pretty
interesting
cool.
how that all works.
It is. So yeah, I mean that. So within a couple of years, Joe Satriani's really well known, and then I'm doing my first gigs. By the 2 years later, I'm 16, and I'm doing my first gigs with Legacy, which would become Testament. And so I've had this conversation with friends of mine who are musicians. Sometimes we'll talk about great advice we got and terrible advice we got. And probably, so I often say, some of the worst advice I got was, don't go to this guy Joe for lessons. And luckily I didn't listen.
That's some terrible advice.
Yeah. And then some of the best advice I got was from Joe himself, who, among, many pearls of wisdom he had, one of them was, never try to be like the guitar player of the moment. Yeah, whoever that is. Now, for the longest time, that was Eddie. And of course, it's great to learn things from Eddie. I still learn things off those early Van Halen records, but people would just only focus on the flash of the technique and at the fact that he had, just such a great rhythmic sense and just, a great blues feel. And then for a while it was Stevie Ray Vaughan, and I even knew people in the Bay Area, that would, buy the Stevie Ray Vaughan Stratocaster, wear a hat, and just, really like try to be just like him. And
Stand outside in the rain anytime it rained.
yeah, and I have friends who grew up in Austin at the time. Eric Johnson was popular even before he was nationally known, and there was a whole group of people that would dress just like him and try to play just like him. And so it was funny, and I guess in hard rock and metal at the time, so Yngwie, when I came to Joe, like Yngwie was sort of the guy, and he said, it's okay to learn the stuff, learn these arpeggios, and I'll help you learn it, but don't copy his feel. Don't try to be just like him. Try to have a lot of different influences. And it's just funny that a couple years later, the guitar player of the moment that everybody was trying to copy was Joe Satriani himself.
Yeah, well, I like that idea of I've trained in Krav Maga, which incorporates a lot of hand-to-hand combat techniques from various fighting styles around the world.
Yeah,
And
sure.
I love that idea of getting all these different tools, putting them in your own toolbox and using them in a way that's specific to you and being open to constantly adding to them. Yeah, that
Yeah, I
seems
think it's the
way
only
better.
way to do it. Because you're not going be able to mimic somebody else, no matter how much you try.
And I think this also brings us kind of full circle talking about, that through line from Chuck Berry and The Killer to The Beatles to Sabbath to, and so on. When I think about Metallica, for example, when I heard Metallica, I'd never heard Diamond Head, obviously. I mean, most people hadn't.
Yeah,
I hadn't
had.
heard Motorhead, and it's like in many ways, Kill 'Em All is Motorhead and Diamond Head combined, but it's still through the prism of the unique life experiences of, this street kid, Dave Mustaine, and this Danish almost tennis pro. And you know what I mean? You put all those combustible elements together and you get these songs that could, while they're, you can see the ingredients, the meal wouldn't have tasted the same if it had been cooked by someone else.
Yeah, absolutely. And even it's funny, we with Metal Allegiance, we recently played the Prowler from the first Maiden album.
Nice.
And the guitar solo section on that, it's Motorhead. It's more technical. Yeah, it's much more technical. You know, they maidenized it, but it's basically, it's what I think of as the Motorhead groove. And you can hear that in a bunch of the Metallica stuff. But, you know, of course, when Metallica does it, it sounds like Metallica. But it's just great to hear, you know, bands sort of, you know, borrow, but, you know, filter it through this this prism that makes it sound unique.
Yeah, I remember when the first Coldplay record came out, someone telling me, you know, this is just U2 plus Radiohead. And I'm like, yeah, but you didn't think to make U2 plus Radiohead.
That's right.
you know, it's just Black Sabbath plus Typo Negative. Yeah, that's a great idea.
Sure.
And it is always sort of through, it's going to inevitably sound unique to the artist that's creating it. I would imagine doing the Metal Allegiance thing, you know, and unpacking all these, the songbooks of all these classic bands and doing some reverse engineering, you're probably making all sorts of discoveries like that. Like, hey, wait a second. this actually reminds me of this. I'd never noticed before.
Yeah, and I, you know, I'll use those as references. Whereas, you know, it's fun to learn all this music as an experienced musician.
Right, right.
Oh, I know exactly what they're doing. Yeah, you know, mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, when I was hearing that stuff for the first time as a kid, it was so mysterious and so magical. And it's, you know, it's still exciting to listen to. But now, you know, just having made, you know, having dozens of records and knowing the process and knowing how guitar tones are made and how songs are written, you can, it's fun to check out all this music with, you know, a new perspective and understanding.
So as all of that was happening in the Bay, you know, Exodus and Legacy and Legacy becoming Testament, and obviously, of course, Metallica, as that was developing this Bay Area thrash scene that of course would eventually incorporate and encompass, you know, everything from Violence to Death Angel to Forbidden and, you know, third wave and fourth wave and whatever you want to, however you want to categorize that stuff now. Did you have a sense at the time that you were part of something that could be described as a movement or a scene or a genre within a genre? Or, you know, all these ways that, you know, for me, a kid growing up in Indiana, reading about that as it was happening and discovering it and that sort of thing, it seemed like this, you know, like Camelot or something, like, you know, some sort of, you know, like thinking about like the New York jazz scene or Delta blues or something, you know. Was there any sense that there was something sort of electric happening, or what was the vibe?
I don't think so, because, you know, we were in our own little island, basically. That's what it felt like, an island. And, you know, who knew what was happening anywhere else? You know what I mean? Like, obviously, if you're in New York at that time, then there's, you know, there's some other scene happening. Or if you're in Austin or Chicago, you know, I think we just weren't aware of it. So I didn't know. I mean, the whole thing was very mysterious to me. Like, I wasn't sure. You know, it's not like things weren't as connected as they are now. You didn't have the internet. You didn't have, you had music magazines, but they were mostly focused on bands that were, you know, extremely well known. You have stuff like magazines like Circus, Hit Parade, or Metal Edge. Right. Everybody in those magazines had a record deal. If they weren't headliners, they were supporting headliners. And
yeah, those magazines weren't writing about bands in the tape trading scene.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Now, there was the tape trading scene, and we did hear about bands in other areas. So, for example, like I knew about the band Sabotage. Even though they had a record out, it was out of print. And I remember having, it's ironic because I would end up doing a record with them.
Yes.
Yeah, that's which is a whole other story. Which leads to this other thing called the Trans-Siberian Orchestra.
And Savatage was supposed to play the first metal show I ever went to, which was Dio, Megadeth, and Savatage, that tour.
That's right.
Where I bought that Megadeth shirt. But my date in Indianapolis, and I don't know why, but for whatever reason, Savatage canceled that date. They were on the bill, and they had merch set up there for sale, but they didn't play.
Ah.
But yeah, again, the small world of all this stuff, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I just heard, okay, there's a band from Florida, so there must be all these bands in Florida doing stuff. And who knew that? I figured all the bands in Florida probably sound like that. That must represent what they sound like. You know, little did I know, a few years later,
what hear, Florida was going to give us.
the bands from Florida. You know, it's like,
yeah.
Like, wow, what is in the water out there? I knew of Pantera before anybody, you know, before they had ever played in the Bay Area. And actually, I think they were still kind of a glam band at that point. But yet, yeah,
maybe
somehow
pre-Anselmo.
Word had spread. They had this one EP or this album that was out, Metal Magic, I think it was called. And then, you know, of course, you know, you'd hear about European bands. So I just figure, okay, what's happening here is happening everywhere. But little did I know, you know, that it was a unique sound and it was a unique scene.
And how important so many of those bands would be from such a relatively small place that we would.
Yeah, you know. The sheer amount of bands that would go on to achieve fairly high visibility is pretty remarkable. At the same time, you know, we didn't know this at the time. I mean, we didn't know who was going to be well known and who wasn't. So, for every Slayer's, yeah, really Southern California, but once they started playing the Bay Area, they were, as soon as they got rid of the makeup, that is, famous story, they were just welcome. They were like honorary parts of the Bay Area scene. And so for every like Slayer, Exodus, and then later Testament, you know, because we didn't put out an album till 87. And that's, we were really like the freshman class. You know, I was in high school and Megadeth had records out. Metallica had records out. Slayer had records out. So, you know, people talk about, you know, well, the big four thing isn't really fair and you guys should be part of the big four. And I have no problem with it at all because I think it's, you know, a seniority thing. All those bands had records out. And
you guys did Clash of the Titans, which was kind of the proto Big Four tour back in the day.
That's true. Yeah.
I mean, definitely, if there's anybody who's a Big Five and Six, it's no question that Exodus and Testament are those bands in everyone's minds. But yeah, which is a
big honor. You know, that's great, and I'm more than happy with that. That's wonderful. But for every band, whether it's a big four band or even, you know, a big five or six or a big 10, you know, you get into, you have Death Angel and other well-known bands. There are many bands that you'll see on flyers that just, you know, never made it to the stage of doing records. So there were so many bands. And I think at the time it wasn't clear. I mean, I think we knew who was going to last for a while and who was, but for a while it wasn't clear. I mean, I remember a time, and again, I mentioned earlier that, you know, Laz Rocket was the first headliner over Metallica. And I was talking to Kerry King not that long ago, and I had seen their first show in the Bay Area, and I always thought their first show was with Exodus. It was actually with Laz Rocket.
Oh, wow.
All of these bands supported Laz Rocket, and it really seemed like that was the band that was going to go places. Like, and if anything, they were actually more accessible than most of the other bands at the time. And it's a little surprising. I mean, I think you know, they kind of ended up being like the, you know, the MySpace or the Friendster.
Right, of thrash.
Of those bands, yeah.
Totally.
You know what I mean? It was,
yeah.
Like the first thing that came out, but then the ones that followed really perfected it.
And you're so, and I think you're a little closer in age to Rob Flynn, who's also been a guest on the show. And I thought that he had a really interesting perspective on all of this because he was both a fan and a peer of those bands, you know, because like you, he was in high school when Kill 'Em All was out, and he was seeing a lot of those early shows. And obviously, we think of, I think in your case, you're probably associated a little more with that generation, if you can even call it that, right before Rob, even though I think he might be a year or two older than you because you started so much younger.
Yeah, but we were in the same generation, for sure.
And I think that that's one of the more exciting perspectives on, you know, what's become such a phenomenon in the shape of Metallica, in that, you know, for you being one of the stars of Testament with the red guitar when everyone else had the black guitars. I always remember that. You have this really unique vantage point. What was your first encounter with the Metallica guys? Did you meet the guys from the band before you saw them play, or vice versa?
Well, I knew about them because of Exodus. So I had heard this whole story that the guitarist for the Freaky Executives, whose name was Mike Mong, who actually looks a lot like Kirk, or at least he did at the time.
Amazing.
And also half Asian. You know what I mean? It was like a perfect replacement visually. But it's like
Mark from Death Angel said at that MI thing that the first time he met Kirk Hammett, Kirk was like, "You look like me."
Yeah, so Mike Mong replaced him, and he had the same look, and a good guitar player too. But I think, you know, it just after I forget if it lasted a week or a month, and I think he did like at least one gig with them. But he was also he had started jamming with the Freaky Executives, and I think he just decided that, you know, the heavy, ultra heavy thing just wasn't for him.
And at the time, there was no reason to think that there was any commercial success or career stability to be had in playing music that sounded like Exodus or Metallica, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
If you were looking to make music a career, that wasn't the move.
Absolutely. You know, Freaky Executives was this large ensemble, too. I mean, they were like a combination of like Morris Day and The Time and the English Beat. And a couple of the guys in the band even had connections to, you know, Sheila E., who is from the Bay Area, who, you know, was part of Prince's band. And, you know, it just looked like there could be major commercial potential with that band. And I think there could have been you could write a whole book on why things didn't happen with
right.
that band.
Right.
But anyway, so Mike Mong joins that band, and for a while, my brother was the bass player, and I just heard the story. Yeah, Mike Mong briefly replaced the guitarist for Exodus, and I said, "Oh, what happened to him?" "Oh, he joined this other band. They're doing a record, and they're touring, and it kind of looks like they might be going places." And "Oh, what are they called? They're called Metallica. You know, you should check them out. They're going to be coming around, you know, blah, blah, blah." So I go to see Metallica. They played the same place where everybody else played in Berkeley. It was called the Keystone Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd already seen Exodus there. I'd already seen Lars Rocket there. And in a way, it was like this unfulfilled dream of mine. You know, it's so frustrating in a way. I never got to play there because it closed down before I was gigging. I think it closed down like a year before I did my first gig. So at this point, I've played the Cow Palace, I've played Madison Square Garden, I've played Radio City Music Hall,
but right. But no Keystone Berkeley.
I never got to play the Keystone Berkeley.
That's amazing.
Anyway, so this is, you know, this is our local place, and everybody had played there. So Metallica comes through, and I guess they were on tour, and they had their record out. And I remember,
was this Raven, Metallica, and Exodus, by any chance?
I think so.
Because that would have been, you and Rob Flynn may have unwittingly been at the same first Metallica show.
Yeah, that's probably
because that's the one he was at.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, the Kill 'Em All for One tour.
I hadn't discovered Raven yet, and actually, when I think I missed Raven, and I think Metallica headlined because they were it was the Bay Area, and they had relocated there at that point. But all I know is seeing Metallica, it was just like, all right, this is on a whole other level. And I couldn't explain why. I just thought, like, seeing, Exodus reminded me of a punk show in a way. Even though it was, you know, it was metal, but it was just breathtakingly fast. A lot of punks would go to the show too. Like, they really had a mix of like a punk and a metal following.
You know, and now that you mention it, I would say that, you know, similar to the switch from Paul Di'Anno to Bruce Dickinson, you know, Bailiff had kind of a punk thing. You know, he looked like a metal guy, but is sort of erratic all over the place. Vocals and charisma were pretty punk when you
completely
think
about it. And not much melody.
Right, right.
I mean, but it didn't need it because it really wasn't about that.
No,
it's all vibe.
It's all, yeah. Yeah, it's great.
But I felt like, yeah, that, so Exodus, it was a rush to see them. You know, it was like super high energy, high speed, you know, but different than punk because, you know, it really had that metal guitar sound. And solos that were clearly, you know, more inspired by like Maiden and Priest than, say, you know, the Sex Pistols and, you know, Iggy Pop or the Stooges. You know, it had that modern sound, but it was great. But Metallica, for some, like, they achieved the same intensity, but they had a few fast tunes, but they also had tunes where it was very singable. So I remember Seek and Destroy. Just thinking, oh my God, that's like a sports anthem.
Right.
And then it's just this perfectly crafted tune for James to trade off with the crowd.
Now you even have arenas singing the riffs in that song.
That's true.
And they play it live and it's, oh, oh, oh. I mean, yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah, exactly. So I never would have guessed how huge it was going to be. Like, I thought, okay, if these guys play their cards right, maybe, you know, they could be on a level of, say, you know, Maiden or Priest. Maybe. Or Ozzy, you know. I wasn't even sure, though, because it's...
Yeah, even that was lofty. Right.
Yeah, that was huge. All those bands were, you know, arena bands at the time. But I never would have guessed that, yeah, not only are they going to reach that level, they're going to outlast those bands at that level. They're going to play stadiums where a lot of those bands will end up consolidating their venues, mm-hmm, and switching to smaller theaters. And you know, they will be mentioned along, you know, like the biggest acts in music, like Springsteen and U2 and Madonna. I never would have guessed that, but I did. I could tell, all right, they have something special, and they're going places. They're going places beyond where all the other bands are going. I don't know where that is, but I'm going to keep an eye on.
This past week, the Black Album sold 3,000 copies in America. This week, February 2018. I mean, it's just, that's madness, you know.
Yeah.
And they own it now. It's on their own label.
Good for them.
I mean, it's just, yeah, it's incredible. One of the things that I enjoy and respect about you is that not only are you such an accomplished player and musician and everything from Trans-Siberian Orchestra to what you do with the trio and, you know, just you as a guitar player, and you, but you're also just so affable and friendly. And on top of that, as I'm singing your praises, I like that you are plain spoken and enthusiastic. You know, a lot of times when people say opinionated, it has this negative connotation, right? Like that person spouts off and criticizes things. And I think that you're opinionated in a way that you will have these open commentaries on things like a fan, you know, because you're so well established in your own right as a musician and a player and somebody in the pantheon of this legendary Bay Area thrash thing, if nothing else, aside from everything else. And yet, you know, you did this essay about Lulu or Death Magnetic, and even more recently, you know, a year ago, the Lady Gaga Grammy thing. And as a bit of a cultural commentator myself, I've always been drawn to that and thought it was really cool, especially cool. Given your kind of insider status on that kind of thing, you know, that you're able to experience those moments in culture as someone who's lived it in a sense and also as someone who's observing it like the rest of us.
You know, it's interesting. I don't seek attention with those commentaries as you know, hard as that may be for some to believe. Like, I don't
of course. Yeah.
Allow it to get... I post the stuff on my blog for, you know, for my readers or, you know, whoever's interested. And I don't, I'm always surprised that it resonates so much or it causes so much controversy. But to me, it's, I never try to be controversial for the sake of being controversial or opinionated. I just, I like to share perspective, and I like to be honest, and it sometimes gets me in trouble because I'm very bad at, sort of putting on a front. Like, I can't. That's one of the reasons why I do music and why I don't work in an office where I have to smile at the boss and sort of not say what I'm really thinking. You know, I could never be in that situation. So I think that, you know, it comes out in my writings and also in my music. I mean, I think I always felt like, you know, just because I'm known for this certain genre of music and where the majority of musicians are, you know, stick to that genre, which that's great. I support that. I've never felt like that should limit me as a musician. And I like to work with musicians, you know, many different types of musicians outside of that genre. And I think from my real metal phase was around the time I joined Testament, where I was 16. And I had these few years where I was like, okay, you know, I'm a metal guy. You know, most of my listening is, you know, Randy Rhoads, Yngwie, you know, Blackmore, Dio. And then, you know, I discovered great instrumental music. And I, you know, keep in mind, I'd been a Satriani student. So I'd already, that was always a part of my development. But for some reason, it shocks some people that, you know, I sort of pursued that, the instrumental side or the jazz improvisation, whatever you want to call it, simultaneously. But to me, it feels totally natural.
Just like it felt natural for you to like all those different bands as a kid, even when the trends would move on and say, now you're supposed to like this stuff now.
Exactly.
I can like all of it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, a year after I discovered Ozzy in, you know, junior high school, nobody was wearing Ozzy shirts anymore. And it's not cool anymore. You know, we've moved on. You're so 1982, man. You know? And No, actually, that makes no sense to me. Ozzy's, you know, I like that music even more. And I'm like, I'm learning. It's going to take years to learn to play this music. But, you know, this, I think I'm always going to like this music. But, you know, at the same time, I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to apologize for liking John McLaughlin and Al Di Meola and John Coltrane and Miles Davis. You know, that's a big part of me too. I don't try to force it on people. Every now and then, you know, I'll see these comments, you know, if I'm doing a tour of instrumental music where I do, you know, one of my albums, or I'll play on somebody else's album. If it gets picked up by a metal website, occasionally you'll see an angry fan. You know, who the hell does he think he is? You know, come on, man, you're supposed to be a thrasher. Just the other day, I saw something like that on my Instagram, and you know, it was just, it's so ridiculous. It's like, you know, I'm not forcing you to listen to my instrumental stuff. I'm not forcing, you know.
Not to mention, I think that it all feeds in, you know, and my experience, and you know, all the creative people that I've known, the more you branch out and do other things, the better, and sometimes even sort of more pure that other project is, you know.
I think so too. I think it gives you a different perspective.
And sometimes I think bands get ruined by that. If you have people who are painted into a corner or in this creative cage and feel that they're only supposed to do a certain type of thing, sometimes you get these bad albums that are a result of them butting up against those constraints. Whereas oftentimes you let someone go wander and explore everything, and it's that much better for kind of the purity of the original thing.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I'm more drawn to musicians that are, you know, they're not purists, or, and I, you know, there are some great purists too. But you know, I guess it just, yeah, it feels natural for me to play different types of music. I think I also got to a point where with heavy metal guitar, it really requires a lot of technical facility. And it seemed to me like, wow, you know, if I have all this technical facility, I can use that to and apply it to other music I like, whether it's, you know, jazz fusion or, you know, I like, there's even some country guitar that I like. And
almost
I
like you were developing those skills without realizing it. You know,
like, yeah, absolutely.
You know, kind of a Karate Kid wax on, wax off kind of thing.
That's exactly right. And the vast majority of feedback I get is incredibly positive. And I have people tell me that, you know, they're not afraid to open their minds to other kinds of music because of me. I just did a tour with my trio, and I played a place called Yoshi's, which is where I saw all my favorite jazz artists growing up. And that was like what the Keystone Berkeley was to me. Yoshi's was to me on the jazz improv side of things. And to play there was just, yeah, incredibly fulfilling. And yeah, I've played at a number of venues like that, and I always meet people at the shows that have never been to a concert. Like, they've never had that experience of coming to a show, sitting down, not talking, listening, enjoying a glass of wine, and just really getting into the music as a listener. There's no, you know, and I sometimes joke about, you know, the mosh pit. Yeah, there's no mosh pit here tonight, guys. You know?
Well, I mean, as you astutely pointed out once about Lars being the bridge between Motorhead and MoMA, you know, Alex Skolnick is definitely a bridge between thrash metal and jazz fusion for a lot of people.
And it's fun. And it, you know, it sort of shows these fans, you know, in some cases, people have this other experience and they start going to other shows. They realize, you know, and I like it's really coming from a place of sharing. It's not, it's never about, oh, you know, look at what I can do, and, you know, look how I can play guitar. In fact, the music I play, you know, in all my instrumental projects, it's as much about the other instruments as it is about the guitar. And, you know, a long time ago, I saw Jeff Beck for the first time. And, yeah, I think he's a great example of that, where it's really not just about him. I mean, yes, the guitar is terrific, but you hear so much other, there's so much great stuff to be heard from the musicians he's playing with. And I think sometimes, you know, with the whole instrumental shred movement, sometimes that gets lost. And I know when I started doing instrumental music, people expected me to do sort of like a metal version of like the Satriani Vai thing, which, you know, it just wasn't for me, because it's so, I don't want to just show off on guitar. I really want to create music that I'm interested in. And, you know, yes, you can go see me on a tour with Testament, and you'll hear like screaming, blistering metal, and I put my heart into it, and I love playing that. But there's 24 hours in the day. I'm not listening to metal 24 hours a day.
Yeah, I mean, it would be like only watching comedies all the time, you know, or absolutely, only watching comic book movies, or, you know, sure, I totally get that.
And I like, you know, I like artists who are diverse. I mean, you know, I like, an actor. Maybe I could see an actor in a superhero film, and, you know, maybe doing metal can be like that. You know, it's like larger than life, and it's this intense experience. But then you can see the same actor doing some independent Sundance award-winning film.
Yeah.
And it makes perfect sense. Or, you know, I love watching the career of Rick Rubin, you know, who went from, you know, producing, you know, Slayer's Rain and Blood to working with Johnny Cash.
Right. Right.
And what's the difference between the two? You know, they're both great music.
Yeah. And I remember the first time I ever heard Public Enemy, realizing that they had sampled Slayer, and then figuring out, like, wait, and, you know, making all those connections.
Absolutely. So to me, it's, you know, it doesn't matter. So I've always admired, there's a number of artists that are like that, and I've always sort of wanted to be like the guitar version of that type of art.
That's killer. And I want to tell you something that you wrote that really resonated with me, which was your piece on Lulu, because, you know, one of the things you said early into it was that, you know, you had to admit you didn't like it, but you were fascinated by it. And that's a camp that I completely understand, and I think is important to explore. Because first of all, I like how you contextualized it with, you know, John and Yoko and Pat Metheny and, you know, Lou Reed, you know, years prior to that, Andy Warhol, this sort of stuff, because I do think that that's the best way to view it and sort of what makes it fascinating. And, you know, what I've said this on this podcast before, and then prior to talking to you today, I read the Lulu thing when it came out, and then I reread it today to kind of refresh my memory on it. And, you know, what I've said on the podcast before is that I don't begrudge them on seizing the opportunity to collaborate with Lou Reed when it presented itself and seeing where it went, and then, yeah, throwing in this German expressionism and all this weirdness and making a record. My feeling as a fan is that it then should have been put on a shelf,
right,
locked away in a vault, and then someday, you know, perhaps when the band isn't able to tour anymore, or God forbid, we've, you know, a significant member passes away, or whatever the case is, when you're in that twilight sort of legacy, you know, like an Elvis or a Tupac or something, then you go, hey, there's this thing we unearthed, this gem, this oddity, from the Metallica vault, and you kind of trot it out as a curiosity and go, you know, they made a whole art concept thing with Lou Reed once. And I think that had it been presented in that way, it may have had a chance of being even better accepted.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. And I think that, you know, the whole thing can be summed up in like six words, which is really what triggered me writing about it, which is the six words are, "You're not supposed to like it."
Right. Wow. That's awesome. And
everybody was going nuts and they're talking about it. Like, and the whole reaction to it, I think, was part of it started to make sense in this very strange way. And I had to share it. And yeah, I'm not going to name drop, but I got approval from within the organization.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Yeah. That was like, oh, yep, you got it.
Because I think that, you know, and this was the point that you made that I was reminded of this morning that takes it a step further than I do and that I really have to kind of marinate in, because I think there's really something to it. Your point was also even that the mere act of releasing it is part of the art of it.
Like,
whereas I'm like, I understand why they made it, but why did they have to put it out right now? And I love, you know, if I can quote you even where you said, think about it. Lou Reed and the world's biggest heavy metal band get together, bond over German expressionism, create an album that is difficult to digest, and release it to the world. If that's not art, I don't know what is. And yeah, wow. I mean, and what a chance in that sense. What an artistic sort of risky. So, well, that's great. And I won't try to interrogate you on it any further, but I do love.
No, I mean, that's exactly right. What you're saying. And sure, and I understand your point. Yeah, you could debate. Maybe they should have put it away.
Well, most people would say they shouldn't have even made it. And I'm already in an adversarial Metallica defender camp by telling people that I completely understand them making it. But yeah,
I think it would be a great, it would have been a great collector's item.
Yeah,
so I could see that. I mean, you know, Prince had the Black Album,
right. Which was never going to be as good as you imagined it to be.
It was not supposed to be released.
Right.
He was pissed that they actually released it. But you know, it's one of those. It was an experiment.
Like Eddie and the Cruisers, A Season in Hell.
Right. Yeah.
One of my favorite parts about that movie is the like mythic, you know, unreleased. Dark,
but it's so interesting.
Album.
Any time I do have this burden, like anytime I write about it, about anything, pretty much, yeah, people see it through this filter that, oh, it's the guy from Testament.
Yeah, and you mentioned that in the piece, which was kind of what I was getting around to earlier.
This is not the guy from Testament writing about this. Like, try to separate, please. Try to, you know, with a disclaimer. And it's difficult. I understand why, but I actually have it's not that I'm not proud of, you know, my existence as the guy from Testament, but that's not, I don't live as the guy from Testament 24 hours a day. And it was the other part of me that's not the quote unquote guy from Testament that wrote that article.
Yeah, and I completely understand that, and I think most thinking people and fans and admirers of yours will understand that too.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of non-thinking people out there.
Yeah, but you always got to remember to quote Metallica: "The empty can rattles the most." And I always like to point out, I've said this to bands for years, where it's like, okay, so see this news article, you just announced tour dates and there's 40 comments saying they wish your bus would crash and you would all die. Just keep in mind that for the 40 people that left those shitty comments, you know, 40,000 people said, oh, tour dates for this band, cool, are they coming to my town? And then went about their day. So it's always the perspective, like the people that actually take the time to comment with this enthusiastic negativity.
Yeah.
They're such a small minority compared to people that have goodwill that are like, oh, cool. And aren't spending any time saying anything positive or negative. They're just thinking warm thoughts and going about their day.
You really have to remind yourself. It's like, you know, I did an Instagram post a few days ago, and that's I'm playing a 70s jazz fusion keyboard solo that I thought was awesome from a Tony Williams album. And it's gotten just great comments and people saying, you know, this is why I follow you, because you do stuff like this as well as the metal stuff. And, nice. And of course, you know, there's one guy, you know, what the hell is this? You're a thrasher. You forgot you're a thrasher. This is, I think he said, this just sounds like children's music.
This isn't Trial by Fire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's like one guy.
One guy.
And it's out of like just a line of
and one guy whose day would probably be made better if he actually listened to some children's music once in a while.
Yeah, exactly. And then like a completely unrelated post, but also it went semi-viral, was last year Kanye West was photographed in a Testament chart.
Mm-hmm.
And I only wrote about this because I made a comment about to a friend who posted it online. And of course, you know, my comment got grabbed and turned into a news. And so then I had to like write an actual piece on it. But I knew, you know, of course it's going to be, oh, it's the guy from Testament or the metal guy slamming the rap guy. Just the first thing I had to say, you know, first thing you have to do is not see things through that filter.
Yeah, and you could just as easily could have been talking about Justin Bieber wearing a Metallica shirt, which he has, or, you know, Megan Fox at LAX in a Megadeth shirt, which happened, you know, or Chris Brown in his punk jacket with all these punk stickers on it.
Yeah,
you know, it's kind of fine. A case by case, you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
Megan Fox, who would...
I was going to say, if you don't enjoy Megan Fox in a Megadeth t-shirt, I've got nothing in common with you.
Yeah. But the problem, you know, and I have no problem with him per se. And, you know, I think anybody's allowed to wear whatever they want, but it's just, I don't like what he represents in particular, just mainly because his associations, like the whole Kardashian clan.
Yes.
That's really what that was about. But, you know, it's nothing about, you know, like him being a rap guy wearing a metal shirt. In fact, I think there's rap guys now that, to me, have way more cred than some metal bands. I mean, you know. Like Ice-T is killing it, and Daryl McDaniels from Run DMC, and you know, like I would never question any of these guys because you know these are real fans,
right?
And
right,
you know, Kanye's defenders have told me, you know, he listens to a lot of music. He probably is aware of you guys. Yeah. Okay, yeah, I don't.
It's
know.
It's hard to imagine. I can say, you know, Pete Wentz from Fall Out Boy. He's there's a bunch of photographs. I think it might even still be his Twitter profile picture. He's wearing a Ride the Lightning t-shirt. And I happen to, you know, my own small world life story. I've known Pete for many years prior to Fall Out Boy. And I can unequivocally say he was a Metallica fan way back then. Sure. So, you know, some people see that and they go, oh, this guy in this pop band trying to wear this Metallica shirt. And it's like, yeah, that guy in that pop band I know in particular could probably talk circles about Metallica, like around you, you know?
Oh yeah. And you know, Matt Nathanson and I, we're friends online, and you know, he's a super pop guy. I mean, he's like tours with John Mayer and
right.
It's probably lighter than music than John Mayer. Yeah. But he really knows his metal. And really likes it. And Ryan Adams.
Oh, sure.
So yeah. There's a bunch of these guys. Like, yeah, sure. You know, you wouldn't question it at all. But with the Kanye thing, yeah, it was coming off on the coming on the heels of some really weird Kanye behaviors. Yeah, sort of like butchering Bohemian Rhapsody at the Glastonbury Festival. Visiting Trump Tower.
Yes.
And just all kinds of weird stuff. And
I love, by the way, that wearing the Testament shirt was another log on that fire. Like that, you know, that's like on the list of like, he went to Trump Tower, he butchered Bohemian Rhapsody, he wore a Testament shirt. What is he doing?
Well, exactly. It was just the timing was really.
Could you assemble all of those little facts together and say that that's like a Lulu style art installation of Kanye's?
Like, maybe, but I guess I draw
giving
the
him
line.
Too much credit.
Yeah, the whole reality show factor, you know, which is it's more his other half than him, but still, that just ties into this whole entity of, you know, these Ryan Seacrest type shows that I believe are helping destroy America.
Yeah, those are definitely adverse elements to our culture, for sure. For me, I always come back to intention, and I think that whether or not something is art is, has to do with authenticity and meaning, and does this, whether or not I connect to this art or enjoy it, I can appreciate that it's being made with some sort of pure intention. And I think there's a lot of commercial films and music and television and reality television, certainly, that's being made with some other aim in mind. And in some cases that's innocuous, right? Where it's like, well, I want a song that's going to be a banger at the club and this and this and that. And I understand that that's not for me. And I understand that there's a workmanship and a mechanics involved in that, that requires talent, skill. But I don't see it as art because I don't think that it's expression that's being made for its own sake. I think it's a calculated, you know, means to an end. So.
Yeah, which, you know, you could say the same thing about Gaga, for example, and what she does. But she's, you know, a ridiculously talented musician who can sing.
And I think
like
she really knows
nobody's
her metal.
She also knows her metal, yeah.
Yeah, she loves Iron Maiden.
Yeah, and she can sing and play piano like nobody's business and loves metal. Yeah, I would have advised her to do a few things different on her collaboration.
I would have. The biggest, the most egregious part of all of it was were all those extras. I don't know what else to call them. The like faux metal H&M store.
I think I might have said that in my piece.
Probably did. I needed to refresh.
They look like a Hot Topic ad. You know,
it was if even they made Hot Topic look like the Sex Pistols.
Yeah,
it was like a Abercrombie ad. And you know, what's interesting in talking about this in the wider culture, even I've told this story on this podcast before, so I'll make it very brief. But years ago, I saw Metallica play like a 1400 cap room as part of Comic-Con. And at that show, because it was Comic-Con and it was, you know, kind of a place to be, it was like, you know, you look around and there's like the guy that plays Daryl from The Walking Dead. And then, of course, like Rob Halford was there and Brian Posehn. And well, I look over when the band starts and I see Bradley Cooper's a few feet away from me. And I thought, I'm as guilty as anyone, I thought, you know, it's a movie star trying to hang out at the Metallica show because that's like the place to be. You know, this dude's here at Comic-Con, probably never seen a comic book or heard a metal song. And then the band starts and he is air guitaring the whole set. He knows every word, every drum fill, like a legitimate fan. And I'm like, oh, okay, Bradley Cooper, he's a legitimate Metallica fan. That's awesome.
Yeah,
and then you fast forward a year or two, maybe they did another Underplay charity show here in LA, and another at the Fonda Theater, another very small venue for them. And Bradley Cooper was at that show, and I saw him standing back by the soundboard with Lady Gaga, and thought, well, that's cool. And come to find out after the fact, around the time that the Grammy collaboration was happening, apparently it was at that show where after Bradley Cooper's working with Lady Gaga on a movie, and apparently he introduced her to Lars at that show and they were all hanging out, and it was somehow that's where the Grammy thing eventually developed and happened.
So, oh, that's so interesting.
It's kind of neat to see that little through line as a fan, you know, to develop. And yeah, I was at that Grammy performance. It's the only time I've ever attended the Grammys outside of covering, you know, the red carpet and the related events. It's the only time I've ever actually gone and been and had a seat. And I was there with my buddy Josh, who's been on the podcast before. Josh, who I'm sure you know him. He created the Golden Gods Awards. And
of course. Know him well.
Mr. Bernstein, one of my closest pals.
Great dude, yeah.
We were together, and we often talk about how it was like, this must be how sports fans feel when you know, their favorite team gets to the World Series or the Super Bowl and then just eats it. As we were, you know, we're so excited, and it's like, you know, they're like our ambassadors for our a whole lifestyle, you know. And then seeing what was going down right there in the flesh, it was just so infuriating and disappointing. And I'll also say, and I've said this a lot, but you know, I know people that work at the Recording Academy who do actually give a shit and care, and were every bit as disappointed and mortified, if not more so, than Josh and I, because they know the rep that the Grammys has with metal, and they knew what a Jethro Tull size setback that debacle was going to be. And you know, sometimes it's important to remember that these institutions aren't just monolithic entities, that there are humans in them, and you know, people that are 20 years younger than me that are working at the Grammys that definitely weren't around for the Jethro Tull moment, you know. Sure. that are super bummed that Metallica got the shortest straw, as it were.
Yeah, perfect choice of words.
So
yeah, it's too bad, because I thought the idea was great. Yeah, and also, you know, I would have consulted with her on wardrobe.
Yes. Yeah. It had a very a theatricality to it in a way that, in a negative way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she was sort of dressed like a little fangirl groupie.
Yeah, and I was able to see the there's footage online of the sound check, which I think Metallica might have even put it up, because you can the rehearsal, because you can actually hear the vocals, and the stage dive that she did during the performance, she does in the exact same spot in the rehearsal for like a couple stage hands, and that was kind of a I know it's a performance, but. Oh, was it the stage dive? Was that calculated? Like, that's kind of,
yeah,
you know,
yeah. And I think she, you know, she could have covered up a little bit and still been sexy as hell.
Yeah, agreed.
But done it, you know, it just would have had a little more integrity. You know, she can do whatever she wants in her own show.
That's what I mean. Like, normally saying Lady Gaga and theatricality in the same sentence, I mean it as a compliment. You know? You know, like a Marilyn Manson show or Alice Cooper or something, you want it to be theatrical, but yeah, this is a different theater in a different
sense. Didn't think that, yeah, I appreciate that she, you know, she did the thing with Tony Bennett.
Yes.
And there, yeah, it's such a contrast, because she's dressed, yeah, you know, like this classy lady, you know, and it works great. And no, she doesn't need to look like that with Metallica, but
yeah, you know, she could have dressed like Lizzie Hale with Metallica.
Totally. Just not like you're in the, you know, Motley Crue girls video.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. There was so much about the artifice of it that was like an idiot's version of what metal is, you know.
Yeah.
We're going to have fire and people dancing around and
Waving. Yeah. Okay. Why is this so hard to get this right, guys?
I know. And those extras on stage all were moving around in a way as though they had never heard the song or heard a rock song or been to a concert. You know, it's just sort of like, hey, we just need you guys to get up there and rock out.
Yeah, they didn't help.
No. I did enjoy that I saw Metallica a couple of times after that, and each time when they play that song, and Hetfield introduces it as, you know, this time with vocals.
Ha, ha, ha. That's funny.
That's pretty great. So I want to ask you before I let you go, you know, obviously talking about Metallica and Lulu are blights to many fans on the Metallica landscape. What have been a couple of the high points for you and you know, momentous Metallica occasions that you've either gotten to experience directly by sort of being around or just as a fan that I mean, certainly the Black Album comes to mind. It's like a, okay, this is a different, they're on another planet from the rest of the world now.
Well, the funny thing about that is, you know, I'm not one of these people that thinks the Black Album ruined Metallica, you know, and I've had arguments with people about it because I think, like sound wise, that's one of their, not only one of their best sounding albums, I think it's just one of the best sounding albums, period.
Absolutely.
Right. And the vocals, like he was at his prime there. He still sounds great, but there he had all the aggression. It was like the perfect blend between, you know, like the melodies that he's doing now, which I think are terrific. And like, the first album he had, it was so brutal. It really wasn't melodic enough. Like that band really probably, if they'd never evolved from that sound, they probably wouldn't have blown up the way they did.
Agreed.
Right. But the Black Album, I feel like he had that same aggression that he had from the first album, but he had the melody that he would develop later. It was like the perfect blend.
Yeah, and I feel like they revisited that a bit with Hardwired because he brought back some of those Black Album vocal melodies that were absent on Death Magnetic, which was
absolutely.
Like,
yeah. I was really glad to hear that.
Yeah, it's probably my favorite thing about it.
Yeah, I think it's great. Now, if it were up to me, I would have had that be their, you know, that would have been their Rumors, you know what I mean, or their you know, their Joshua Tree or their big, their most commercial album. And then from there, okay, now you can sort of, you know, get back to more, you know, more straight ahead sounding stuff or, you know, experiment here and there. But I wasn't a fan of like the period that followed, you know, the whole, it seemed like, okay, now we're going to be even more commercial.
Yeah.
The whole load.
That worked. Let's go to get a step further. Yeah. And I sympathize
understand
with that.
Though, because then at that point you're in this whole other position and you've established yourself to, you know, many people who this huge audience that wasn't aware of you before. And that's, you know, that's got to be a whole other position to be in. So
and I've always argued that they were being as true to themselves in the 90s. Granted, there were internal squabbles about the direction and the image and all that, but I think they were being as true to themselves then as they were in the 80s, in the sense that by the 90s, they were listening to Alice in Chains and Soundgarden, and Lars was really into U2 and Oasis, and you know, there were other things that were happening that were turning them on, both in their lives sort of experientially and musically. And for them to have made records in the 90s like the ones that they made in the 80s, I think would have been false in a sense. And that's usually my take on the whole reload era in general. And I would also argue, and I'd be curious for your opinion, there are, once you separate it from all of that and really dig in, there are some undeniably great songs to be found from that era. It's not as immediate as, you know, some of the stuff before and after.
Yeah. And all, you know, so I'm a defender of the Black Album, and I saw them a couple years ago. Testament actually played on the bill with them for the first time. And
for the first time ever,
which is so bizarre.
That's
yeah.
insane. How did I not know that? That's recent.
They didn't either. We were like, we were talking to James, and he didn't believe it.
That seems crazy.
Of course, yeah.
That seems crazy.
When, James? When? When did we play? Believe me? We
were yeah, you guys knew you hadn't.
But it was amazing. Like, just, first of all, like, I love it. They're all, each of those guys, they're their own guy.
Yes.
Like, they really have, you know, separate from this huge thing they're a part of.
It's almost like the Kiss personas, but in real life. Like, yeah. You really do have, like, the Starman and the Demon and the Catman, you know? Like...
yeah. And just, I don't know, just off stage, you can just have these great conversations with, it's James or it's Lars or Kirk or Robert. You know what I mean? And it's totally separate from, it's not the guy, of Metallica. They're just really great guys to talk to, and they all have their individual personalities. And you just almost forget, if you're having a conversation with them backstage, when they're on stage, it's just unbelievable. And we got to watch them from side of the stage. At one point, I think Robert saw us. We were sort of way off to the side. And he talked to one of the security guards and basically came and just pulled us up to the front. Yeah, the little group of guys I was with. It was really awesome. Guys and girls. And we watched right from the side, and it was just a German stadium full. And it's just amazing. I mean, it's just they really have Springsteen, U2 level hugeness, but metal. And they've just figured out a way to do it that really makes sense. And even the songs that I may not have dug that much from, some of the later albums, just hearing them play it live and with that sound system, it was just unbelievable.
Yeah, and I also think some of those songs work well. I wasn't really a fan of the song Fuel, for example.
Oh, yeah.
But I love hearing it live because it really serves a great, it serves a great purpose in terms of dynamics in their set.
Yeah, that's a perfect example. And there's a few songs from that era that they did. And I never liked this song before, but I'm really digging it now.
Yeah. And the idea that you can have a band, like you said, that's Springsteen or Madonna or U2 size, that, once released a 12-minute Merciful Fate medley on a record that went multi-platinum.
I know. It's amazing. It's amazing. So, I just have, beyond, respect for what those guys are doing and how they're able to just keep it exciting and fresh.
So where was the show when you guys finally played together?
This was in Munich.
In Munich, okay, yeah.
There were actually two shows. But the show was called Rock AM Ring.
Okay, sure, yeah. Yeah, wow. That's a big festival. And that's so great. So that's crazy. So you guys had never been on a festival bill together?
It's a
Monsters of Rock or?
Yeah.
Wow. Download?
I think it was a shout out, and we hung backstage. I've bumped into all of them at different times.
Sure.
At other shows or Robert, even jammed with him when my trio was on tour with Rodrigo y Gabriela, and he was a special guest.
Oh, right. Yeah. Because he sat in with them a lot, and they've done Metallica songs. And
So we did a little jam with them. That was amazing. And and I've run into the guys, but, just that was the first time, seeing them in a long time and just seeing how they, they've refined what they do and just how, they've, just not everybody can be a stadium band. I think I saw an interview with, Michael Stipe from REM.
Mm-hmm.
And they became a stadium band. And he said, we're not a stadium band. some bands are meant to be stadium bands.
Yeah, Guns N' Roses.
You too, for sure. And they love, and he was talking about REM specifically, and it's just, it didn't, they did it for a while, but it's very hard to keep that going, and just it suits some bands better than others. And I think, Metallica, they're the great stadium band of metal and, of rock, period.
What's interesting is hearing you say that, having seen Metallica do these underplay situations and then having seen them, most recently at the Rose Bowl, in Pasadena, and then talking about REM and thinking about how much better REM is in a theater than a stadium. I can't picture U2 in a club.
Right.
I love the old U2 records, even, you know. I mean, I love, and that's no disrespect to what they're doing now, but I mean, I love, you know, everything kind of up to and including the Joshua Tree. And yet, yeah, I can't, and I know they even have sort of punk roots, and but yeah, yep. As I was listening to you say that, I'm like, I cannot picture them in a small room.
Right, right.
It would be weird.
Yeah, whereas Metallica, so they're, I think they're even better now than stadiums because they've sort of got in touch with their club side.
Yeah.
Maybe, not that they ever lost it, but yeah, they've done so much.
No, I know what
stuff.
You mean.
I saw them at the Golden Gods as well. That was a little before this. That was great. They did the whole series of shows at the Fillmore.
Yeah, I watched all of those on YouTube. Yeah. I wish I could have gone. But, yeah,
person. They did the show at one of my favorite record stores at Berkeley, Rasputin Records.
Right. Yeah. That was a record store day, and it was like and they did like all old songs too, right? It was all like Kill 'Em All.
Yeah.
And,
Yeah, so they're really in touch with like that side of things as well. So I think it's just so rare for a band to be able to do that and to have all this history and to, you know, go from being this sort of underground phenomenon to this enormous, like larger than life, you know, brand name. And survive it.
My buddy and I at the Rose Bowl, we were counting every time we saw the $10 Metallica shirt from Target.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's very recognizable.
Sure.
And we had a fun little game where we're walking around, we're like, there's one, there's one, there's one. Like, it was just bought the shirt at Target, $10, came to the show.
Right.
I mean,
they have them at H&M now. Yeah.
Yeah, crazy. So great. Yeah, from the Keystone Berkeley to the Rose Bowl.
Yeah. I know. It's just so funny. If, you know, sometimes I'm not going to say I'm a regular H&M shopper, but you know what? they make a really good stage shirt.
I own some H&M.
Simple black.
There's some of my closet. Yeah.
They make some good stuff. So I'll go in there and then I'll see their, you know, some item with the Metallica logo. So surreal. Hi, guys. Yeah.
Exactly. Hey, dudes.
Yeah, you guys are everywhere now, but it's awesome.
That's incredible. Yeah, I've had the opportunity over the years to interview Kirk multiple times, actually, and he's always great as advertised. I've gotten to meet and hang around Robert a few times in different situations, and I got to interview James once. And interestingly enough, Lars is the one I've yet to encounter. Still,
oh, you got
hoping
yeah,
to do that.
Yeah, he's an amazing person. I mean, he's just, you know, incredibly, incredibly creative. I think he would have. I think they should study him. You know.
Yes. Yeah. Hey, no Lars, no Metallica. I'm a huge, huge believer in. Outspoken defender of that idea.
And also, I think, like, you know, no matter what he did, he would have been creative and done it differently. And I think, he watching his creativity has just really, really been fascinating. Even though, you know, there's moments that are controversial that some might not agree with, such as the whole Lulu thing. But I think. Yeah, that's an important side of what he does is sort of, breaking rules and not being afraid to do it.
Provoke and inspire, you know.
Yeah, like, yeah. And I think
disruptive.
You know,
the
same creativity that brought us Lulu also brought us Master of Puppets much earlier.
Amen.
Same fearlessness. So
and the fearlessness that got him derided by the entire culture during the Napster thing
proved to be
prescient and you know, Jamie Josta actually sells a T-shirt that says Lars was right.
Yeah,
which is right. Amazing. Right. Yeah, I always recommend people go watch on YouTube Lars and Chuck D, which tons of respect for Chuck D, of course, but it's Lars and Chuck D on Charlie Rose circa about 2000, 2001. It's like an hour-long episode, and they're debating Napster. And everything Lars says came true. Yep. And everything Chuck says now in retrospect sounds ridiculous.
Yeah, and Chuck's awesome, man.
And he's awesome. Yeah, tons of respect to him, you know. But and that was the and certainly he was the opinions he was giving were the prevailing opinions at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch it now and to hear everything Lars was saying back then.
Oh yeah, and I remember I had grown up in this era of, you know, like they were the government was threatening to ban heavy metal or at mm-hmm. least like camp down on it. You know, there was the whole commission of Washington Housewives, you know, the PMRC, which found its way to a Megadeth song.
Uh-huh.
And we, you know, it was just amazing, you know, because I remembered that. And then here I am watching this Senate hearing and there's Lars shaking hands with Orrin Hatch and earning his respect. And just like they loved him.
So wild.
He just won him over. You know, he just, it was totally amazing. And suddenly I think that was a defining point for metal beyond the whole debate about the file sharing, which, you know, he I think it's safe to say he was proven right. But suddenly, you know, here's a guy from a metal band, yeah, you know, speaking very eloquently and passionately in front of the U.S. Senate. And I don't know. I thought to me that was kind of a defining moment.
Yeah. And to bring it right into modern, the modern lens, an immigrant.
Yeah.
Someone with dual citizenship and multi languages.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I told him that too. I've discussed it with him. Yeah. Just like how awesome I think that is.
That's fucking great.
Like to me, it's no big deal. Yeah. Of course. You know, nobody was going to do anything. And of course, this was going to happen. And, you know, I'm just thinking, you know, like if any of us, anybody from any metal band, like got put in that position, we're going to go speak to a Senate subcommittee or, you know, that group of senators that he spoke to, like, I could do it. But at that time, I mean, that's like incredibly intimidating.
Yeah. That's wild. Right. But much respect to him and also to Dee Snider at the PMRC.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean,
Dee killed it. Yeah.
And Dee, you know, he was, you know, and Zappa too. I mean,
of course. Yeah. Dee was a little more like
I love Dee, but yeah, he was a little more like
they would have expected. Yeah. Whereas Lars was more sort of like, hey, I can navigate seamlessly in this world and still point across.
Like,
yeah.
Like, hey, you guys respect business. This is about business. We're business people. And I think played a necessary role at that time for that situation. But I think Lars did the unthinkable. Like, he actually earned their respect.
Yeah, that's pretty.
It's pretty awesome.
Pretty powerful, man. Rules. That's great, great perspective and context, which I knew you would bring. And when I first conceptualized of this podcast, if you know, several months back, you were one of the first names I wrote down on my pad.
So glad, man. So glad to be a part of it.
Had to have on. Yeah. And I'd love to have you back sometime because there's
love to come back
to discuss. So yeah, killer. Well, don't be a stranger. And thanks again.
Absolutely. Likewise.
Catch Testament on tour all summer across America with Anthrax, Behemoth, Lamb of God, and Slayer on what Slayer has said will be their final tour. And head over to alexskolnick.com to keep up with all of Alex's activities, to learn more about his book, From Geek to Guitar Hero, read his blog, check out all of his tour dates, check out what kind of gear he plays, look at photos, look at him on the cover of lots of guitar magazines. There's a lot of cool stuff there on his site. And I also recommend following him on Twitter. He's one of my favorite people to follow on Twitter. He always has insightful and often clever things to say. Well, that does it for this episode of Speak and Destroy. You guys have been great, and as always, I've been Ryan J. Downey.